Heute Nachmittag geht es weiter mit Ruth Himes zu Suzanne Duchamp and the Machine Body und dann Christa Baumberger zu Emmy Hennings und dem inszenierten Körper. Nur wenige können sich rühmen, ein Standardwerk geschrieben zu haben. Ruth Himes gehört dazu. Sie hat 2009 das Buch Dada's Women publiziert, in dem sie Leben und Werk von Emmy Hennings, Hannah Höch, Suzanne Duchamp, Sophie Teuber-Arp und Céline Arnaud darstellte und analysierte. Eine Pionierleistung verbrachte Ruth Himes insbesondere damit, dass sie die Pariser Schriftstellerin Céline Arnaud aus der Vergessenheit holte, eine Dadaistin, die bis vor kurzem noch weniger bekannt war als etwa Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven. Derzeit arbeitet Himes, die als Professorin an einer sehr noblen Universität in England, Literaturwissenschaft im Royal Holloway College University of London lehrt, an einer Monographie zu Arnaud. Heute geht es jedoch nicht um jene außergewöhnliche Dichterin, sondern um eine andere Dadaistin aus Paris, um die visuelle Künstlerin Suzanne Duchamp. Man kennt sie am ehesten als Schwester von oder als Frau von. Dass Duchamp aber ein gewichtiges, wenn auch kleines Dada-Werk in Paris schuf, ist wenig bekannt. Ruth Himes spricht nun zu Ihnen, zu ihr und zu Ihnen und zum Maschinenkörper.
Right, I've got to keep the time. I'm aware all that. So that means I have to keep my thank yous very brief as well. No tears or histrionics or gestures, even though I'm in the Cabaret Voltaire. But I'm hugely privileged to be here. I thank you very much, and I thank Ina for bringing us all together and for the excellent exhibition last year that got everybody talking. Fantastic. And also to Adrienne and for hosting us here today. It's a great honour. So I'll begin. In 2016, the boundaries between the human body and the machine are being transgressed and blurred as never before, not least by the march of technology. From computing to prosthetics to robotics, the body is on the one hand being enabled, on the other under threat. 100 years ago in 1916, the sanctity and security of the body was likewise in question, alternately assisted and vulnerable to industrial production, advanced and threatened by machine warfare, cured and exposed by medicine and psychology. For the artists of the avant-garde, the question of how to live in a body and how to represent the body in a rapidly changing social, political, and cultural environment was pressing. Responses were far from uniform, but one discernible reaction was the association of the body and the machine. Mechanomorphic imagery, in which machines or machine parts were used to represent the human body, was to become a characteristic technique associated with Dada. A famous text by the critic and photographer Paul Haviland, printed in the New York Journal 291 in 1915, put into words this fascination with the machine and also draws attention to the impact of technology on artistic expression. And I'll quote from this now. I'll put up a clearer version so you can see it. He writes, "We are living in the age of the machine. Man made the machine in his own image. She has limbs which act, lungs which breathe, a heart which beats, a nervous system through which runs electricity. The phonograph is the image of his voice. The camera, the image of his eye. The machine is his daughter born without a mother. That is why he loves her. He has made the machine superior to himself. That is why he admires her. Having made her superior to himself, he endows the superior beings which he conceives in his poetry and his plastique with the qualities of the machines. After making the machine in his own image, he has made his human ideal machinomorphic." Haviland is referring here not only to the impact of the machine on everyday life, but in particular to its impact on the arts and the artist. And he's specifically referring to the camera. With photography taking over the role of mimesis or illusion of the external world, the artist had to look at other means of representation far removed from the figurative. Machine imagery in Dada work can be said to reflect on this significant cultural shift as well as on socio-political shifts. Haviland's quotation is also interesting for us because of the assignation of the creator as male and machine as female. I'll read you the rest of the quotation. But the machine is yet at a dependent stage. Man gave her every qualification except thought. She submits to his will, but he must direct her activities. Without him, she remains a wonderful being, but without aim or anatomy. Through their mating, they complete one another. She brings forth according to his conceptions. His point is about the camera as an extension of the body and its potential. But this anthropomorphizing of the artist as he and the machine as she, and the associated metaphors of consummation and birth, remind us of the question of relationships between creativity, sex, and gender in the arts and beyond. Again, this period in the early 20th century was putting into question norms of behavior for men and women at work, in the home, in politics, and in the arts. As today demonstrates, there were plenty of wonderful beings, creative women artists with aim and anatomy, who provide us with alternative viewpoints of these turbulent times. Two images produced in the same year, 1916, will serve as well as a starting point for a discussion of the machine as body or body as machine in visual works. Set side by side, they draw attention not only to what was being represented and how, but who was representing it. The image on the left is well known, as is its creator. Fille née sans mère, or Girl Born Without a Mother, is one of many mechanomorphic works produced by the prolific and peripatetic artist Francis Boccabbia, known for his associations with Dada in Zurich and New York and Paris. Boccabbia began producing machine imagery soon after his arrival in New York in 1915. That's in the summer of 1915. I'll bring up that picture so you can see it in more detail. For this exemplary image, the artist took a diagram of a steam engine, embellished it with paint and gold leaf, and gave it a title that is key to its meaning. It is rightly celebrated. It innovates in its conceptual turn as opposed to the figurative. So the human flesh and bones body is absent altogether, and we only glean that it's a girl from the title. It's also interesting for its use of ready-made material, taken from a different framework and declared art. So here the diagram, which he's made almost reminiscent of a medieval painting with this addition of the gold leaf. And thematically, it reviews a conventional subject matter from an old story. So the girl born without a mother, which we also heard in our quotation by Haviland, recalls biblical Eve created from Adam's rib. And it was a theme that was used and reused by Boccabbia. All of this throws into question agency, representation, and creativity from the biblical narrative to which they refer through to the early 20th century artist. The image on the right, produced in the very same year as Boccabbia's Daughter Born Without a Mother, is much less well known, but equally innovative and intriguing. Un est une menacée, or Male and Female Threatened, was made by the French artist Suzanne Duchamp. Born in Blainville near Rouen in 1889, Suzanne was one of four artist siblings. You may know, so you may be familiar with them, a little more familiar than with her, as Adrian said. So she had three older brothers, all artists, so Raymond Duchamp-Villon, Jacques Villon, and Marcel Duchamp. She also had two younger sisters, but they're rarely mentioned. She also went on to marry an artist, the Swiss artist Jean Cortin, who's already been mentioned today. He was her second husband. I've deliberately turned around the normative reference point, sister of and wife of, here, to place her as the protagonist in her own life story. Duchamp trained at the École des Beaux-Arts in Rouen from 1905, and first exhibited locally in 1912, so she was quite young then, still 22. In art historical accounts, her name is chiefly cited in relation to Marcel, not least as the sister with whom he corresponded about his ready-mades, and in fact they worked together on one. I'm going to show this very briefly, but they did collaborate on this Le ready-made malheureux de Marcel, unhappy ready-made, more unhappiness and trauma from earlier on this morning. But beyond this, she also produced a small but fascinating body of work during the years 1915 to 1922. These works share a context and intersect with what Picabia, Marcel Duchamp and others were doing in New York and then Paris, but crucially they also diverge, offering alternative visual and verbal snapshots. So to get back to Un étude menacée, this was exhibited at the Dada-dominated Salon des Indépendants in 1920. Just as in Picabia's work, the title is crucial to activating meaning in a jarringly non-figurative and seemingly non-human work. What immediately strikes us is that where Picabia depicted girl as machine, or machine as girl, in the example we have seen, and in many others, and somebody referred to the Baroness as a spark plug earlier on, so we've seen lots of imagery from him of the woman as machine. Here, Suzanne Duchamp depicts two sexes, a male and a female. But instead of nouns, she chooses the indefinite pronouns un et une, making the relationship to the human even more precarious and distant. The art historian William Canfield is rare in having researched and published on Suzanne Duchamp, and indeed Anne Crotty, and my own work is indebted to his. In 1983, he put on an exhibition of Crotty and Suzanne Duchamp that remains really the catalogue to that remains really the most interesting and most well-researched work. So Canfield notes the fluidity of the identities un et une, but he also thinks about their biographical meanings, so it's a bit complicated. But Suzanne, Jean Crotty was married to someone called Yvonne Chastel. She went on to have a relationship with Marcel, and let me get this right, and Jean Crotty went on to marry Suzanne. So that's the unusual kind of complex relationships. So I think that's kind of an interesting backdrop about her life, but I'm not sure we need it to explain this image because it's precisely that it resists being portraits of anyone in particular. The visual symbolism is complex. The crane might be read as the male. The rectangle with its triangle of circles and clock gear as the female. I should probably point this point. So this is the male, the crane, and the rectangle with the circles as the female. And then there's a pair of sort of like a crescent legs. You can just see that sketched over it. Also, I think, relating to the female. But there are other kinds of ambiguous elements. There's the where the crane has these kind of pincer movement. Canfield said that he thought that was the female, this grasping of the female. And I thought that was a bit stereotyped, actually. I think it is part of the male. And there's this plumb bob, which you can see below the clock gear that's also stuck onto the canvas. And I think that piece is particularly ambiguous. It could refer to the male or to the female. For some reason, while I was teaching last week, it reminded me of this image, which I often use in my Surrealist Women class, this Man Ray photograph, and we've been referring to Man Ray again, Erotique Voilée. This is of Merritt Oppenheim. But that kind of ambiguity, you don't see it at first, but if you look at the big circular shape, machinery overlapping her, machinery and the female body, and you can see the kind of phallic handle sticking out there, you don't quite see it at first. Yeah, it occurs too late, doesn't it, sometimes, if you haven't seen it before. Return to Un étude menacée. So we wonder about how this machine actually might work. And I was thinking of what Elza Adamovic said yesterday about a contraption as opposed to a machine, because actually as a machine it doesn't do anything. And I liked your distinction with a contraption. If anything were to happen, I'll show you an earlier sketch, where she's obviously been working on thinking about, you can see in the pincers that hang down from the crane, there are three chains in this earlier sketch, and they become like one solid movement there. And also, it's much higher up. It looks like it wouldn't actually reach the circular point below. So, any motion of the female structure would entail a rotation of the string around the circles and a continuous movement. It appears self-contained and fluid, but lacks consequence. The male structure, with its crane arm, metal gear and claw, which I think is the male structure, at first appears powerful, sturdy and phallic. But it doesn't actually achieve anything. I mean, it doesn't reach where it might want to reach, if you see what I mean. It falls short of what it's aiming for. So if it would be to be set in motion, because I'm kind of, I have to keep envisaging this, it would only swing from left to right or rotate, ultimately failing to make contact with the images and the icons that I think of as the female. In this respect, the male is far from powerful, but rather reminiscent of the impotent bachelors in Marcel Duchamp's Large Glass. And I'll just, I'm sure you've all seen it before, but I'll just bring that up there. With its bride in the upper area and predatory bachelors in the lower, trapped in their frustrated attempts to reach her. Coming back to Suzanne, coming back from Marcel to Suzanne. So the S on the menacé of the title is also intriguing, indicating that both the male and the female are under threat. This threat might be external, for example, technology, mechanisation or social strictures. Perhaps gender roles are under attack. Alternatively, the threat might be mutually inflicted. In these dystopian aspects, Ernestine Menacé shares common ground with the Large Glass. Instead of romanticised depictions of love, the structure evokes the mechanical or functional aspects of relations between men and women. The entire apparatus indicates the potential of action, yet it is finally powerless and suspended, deprived of any energy source or agency. However, where the Large Glass makes clear a huge gulf between the female bride and the males, the bachelors, in Ernestine Menacé, the male and female at least overlap. And where the Large Glass places emphasis on the predatory mating game and tough rules faced by the male, Ernestine Menacé evokes empathy for both sexes. They seem to be fragilely interdependent, with no perceptible volition, in some kind of trapped together in a Kafkaesque system. The title makes clear that the peril is mutual and shared, one to which the viewer, male or female, either are subject. Suzanne Duchamp's choice to depict a couple rather than only the female is distinctive. If Ernestine Menacé deserves attention for its signifying system, it's also noteworthy for its techniques. It was not only one of the first examples of machine imagery in 1916 in Paris, as opposed to what Picabia was doing in New York, but it was also matchless in combining mechanical drawing and real objects. And again, I'm thinking of the Baroness and the examples that Irénée Gamel gave us earlier. Like Marcel's ready-made, Suzanne appropriates found manufactured materials that confuse the boundaries between the artwork and mass production. And it was quite a departure to do this at this point in Paris. So Ernestine Menacé is exemplary for these unorthodox materials. I hope you can see them from there. I'll just point them out quickly. So here, and the three rings are stuck on, and the clock gear and that little plum bob that I mentioned. So, a second work, Radiation de deux seuls éloignés, or The Radiation of Two Solitary Beings Apart, again depicts a couple and again makes use of unusual materials. It too is a collage. Various found materials, including string wire, glass beads, straw, and crumpled foil, are stuck to the picture surface. I'm going to show you the black and white version, where strangely it's easier to make those out. According to both the inscription and the existence of earlier studies, Duchamp began it in 1916 but returned to it again and again, referring us, the viewer, to a process as well as the finished object. With its grid background, line drawings and geometric shapes, it recalls a technical sketch or design. Linda Dalrymple Henderson has written briefly on this work. She identifies the first and most dominant form in the upper part of the composition as a cage-like antenna. And I've borrowed this diagram from her, actually. You can see how she's tried to make that connection. And the rectangular shape in the lower half, with its large dot in the centre as a receiving grid, the two forms are connected by a vertical line, which is actually made up of two lines that meet in the middle. And in the background, you can see these kind of shapes encroaching, these geometric, circular and triangular shapes. So according to the title, again, we've got two individuals apart in this distanced from one another. So unlike Erne Thun, the Searle in this case in the French does not specify male and female, but we can certainly speculate that she's referring to that. Both Dalrymple Henderson and Camfield, again made biographical readings. Suzanne Duchamp, Jean Croty were frequently separated for a period because of the war, suggesting, you know, that this might be about their separation. The term radiation, meanwhile, used for the transmission of light, energy, or sound, suggests communication at a distance. The image and title together allude to the emission of a magnetic or telepathic force between the two lovers, a metaphor for sexual or romantic attraction, and or the possibilities of communication via new technologies. And this was discussed a little bit yesterday. You know, this was still an interesting topic, you know, the possibilities brought in by new technologies from telegraphy, but also what that meant about telepathy and the way that people communicate. The antenna-like object in radiation might be seen as the woman emitting erotic signals and the receiving grid as the male. And in this case, we can again think about the large glass with the bride emitting the signals. The imagery remains ambiguous, however. The antenna could feasibly be male, the grid with the circular dot in the centre, the female. Like Erne Thun Manesset, radiation differs in any case in that it presents a male-female couple in an apparently less combative relationship, where in Marcel's large glass, the dominant theme is the failure of consummation between the kind of idealised bride and the bachelors. Suzanne's visualisation is less pessimistic. The two lovers are separated but yet connected. A third image arguably echoes the example we've been discussing thematically and formally. And it's funny, you know, when you come back to something, I hadn't quite noticed it before, but now I keep seeing the shape, kind of same the shapes over and over again. A painting with collage elements and a linguistic text, multiplication, in English the title has been translated as Broken and Restored Multiplication, is dated 1919. At the centre of the composition is a structure that resembles a communications tower, or possibly the Eiffel Tower. In either case, as you can see, it's been turned upside down. A series of circular discs in oils and silver paper overlap like a mass of shapes or balloons floating upwards. They're brighter, optimistic colours towards the beginning, the lower half of the composition, and then darker above. In the bottom left-hand corner, you can just make out there's a pale city skyline and a heavy black cross. Which makes us think, you know, of the city and death, as of course, as well. So this work is unusual in that it uses language extensively. And the message in the title itself, again, is typical of how these cryptic titles, is a state of affairs at once broken and restored, with multiplication suggesting possibilities of both fragmentation and reproduction. And again, I'm thinking of Elsa's talk last night about this kind of necessary destruction before you get regeneration. It's almost like a poem that you have to read, you have to activate it yourself, inscribed across the canvas. And you're not at first sure how you should read it, where you should start, there's different fonts, different colours. You have to take, you know, your usual strategies of approaching text have to change. So I've put in the French and in the English there. So, and the mirror would shatter, I'll do it in French. Les glaces se briseraient, les échafaudages crouleraient, les ballons s'envoleraient, les astres s'éteindraient, etc. She has at the end of that. So the viewer has to really work hard, I think, to reconstruct this kind of disorientating text. It's in the conditional, the choice of tense, it's in the conditional, so we could translate them as the mirror would shatter, or sometimes it's used for a kind of to report on something that's hypothetical in the past. So in any case, it's a kind of mismatch between the conditional mode in the text and the past mode of the title, which makes us wonder if this has actually happened or if this is a warning. So again, the verbal is not really anchoring it so much as leaving us as uncertain as we began. And the words, too, are acting out their meaning, which is something I really like about it. So, for example, where you have the scaffolding crumbling, you can see that the words actually crumble. So multiplication and fragmentation are implicit in the work. They are employed as aesthetic techniques, replacing the rational one-point perspective with an onslaught of impressions. We might read this again as a visual vocabulary of modern technology standing in for or alluding to human experience. The tower can be seen certainly as this, you know, as a transmission tower emitting sound waves. You can see how I had lots of fun on Google. I don't think I got a bit carried away with Google. Finding, I suddenly thought, yes, it does look like, you know, the sound waves, and this is how we see a transmission tower. So then I started downloading lots of little images. There you are, which I'm sharing with you here. There is a stark formal contrast between the circles and the tower structure. The circles recall the female signs of fertility, reproduction, the cycle of life. And the tower penetrates the circles, but it's splintered and turns upside down. I'm getting carried away with symbols now because I also saw, someone else pointed this out to me, that you could read, you know, the male and female symbols with the cross at the bottom and this shape with the splintered tower where there's an arrow. So there, that's my fun with PowerPoint. I'm getting too carried away with playing with PowerPoint. So, multiplication prise inévitable is volatile and unstable in what it signifies and how it signifies. The meanings it transmits multiply and crumble along with its verbal and visual enactments. And we have to bring so many modes of reception to it. It might be a vision of wartime destruction, the crumbling of civilization, or shattering of national identity. Read again, it's the violent act of consummation, orgasmic and earth-shattering, that leads to reproduction, continuation and renewal. It encompasses sex, birth, death, nature and industry, the celestial and the earthly. And there's lots of ways of thinking about this piece. So my final, a fourth and final example of Duchamp's work, how am I doing, Ina? Am I okay? Demonstrates with relative iconic simplicity. This is quite a nice, simple example. And actually, the example that's in there, the Dada Globe exhibition at the Kunsthaus Zurich that I saw yesterday, called Usine de mes pensées, Factory of My Thoughts, is also very nice, simple kind of watercolour. So this is a relatively simple example, again, of showing the male and the female without recourse to female bodies. I mean, it seems a bit odd, we're talking about female bodies and I'm talking about the complete absence of the body in all Suzanne Duchamp's work, which is a different way of approaching it. So Seduction from 1920 uses opposing shapes to suggest the male and female. So we've got these kind of feminine, semicircular shapes emanating towards a kind of upright structure. And she also, you can see, I've got the wrong slide. You should have shouted at me. You should have waved or something. It's the wrong slide. Here's Seduction. Have the time to take it in. We've got these semicircular shapes and the upright structure. And also the words, you can just see them, force and grace, force et grâce, strength and grace, I think, which kind of underscore these oppositions, which I think she's referring to the oppositions between the sexes here. And they're kind of acting out as well alongside the two kind of dominant images. Like the large glass, sexual attraction is played out conceptually, but where Marcel depicts predatory bachelors and an unattainable bride, in Suzanne's vision there is a suggestion of mutual seduction, and even the word is split and shared here. You can see it's of successful communication, physical contact, and a coupling. They have in common a fascination with the means of communication between 20th century human beings at a time when technologies and science, as well as social and political changes, were transforming lived experience. We began with Picabia's Girl Born Without a Mother and have just referred again to Marcel's Bride. The points of referencing are seemingly inescapable, but I propose mutually illuminating if and when the frames of reference are expanded and networks of associations are recognised. So I think if we see that Marcel Duchamp's and Francis Picabia's work, you know, and look at others like Jean Crotty, Suzanne Duchamp working alongside and in different places, but responding to the same stimuli in similar but ways, but slightly different in her case. Suzanne Duchamp's work demonstrates an intellectual and aesthetic complexity to match her male colleagues. Her work innovates with its mechanomorphic inventions, its references to scientific advances, its employment of new materials, its humorous references to technology, and its cryptic titles. She provides us with an alternative vision of sexuality, communication, and consummation in male-female relationships. When interpretation becomes challenging, the work of women artists is too often reduced to biographical or narrative readings or private symbolism. You often see personal, private symbolism. I think it's very hard to apply that to work like this. And it suggests a smaller scale of engagement or value. Yet Duchamp tries rather to stretch and expand the possibilities of visual and verbal sign systems. Faced with the dilemma of how to represent the female body, which I think is a dilemma for women artists, which is why I see so many self-portraits, for example. So faced with the dilemma of representing the female body without falling into the traps of tropes like nudes, brides, seductresses, virgins, or widows, she boldly removes the body altogether. Her ambiguous machine and even less material creations, with their uncertain boundaries, force the viewer to think beyond representation of sexed or gendered human bodies in a way that we haven't seen. I think it's very different. When Picabia first showed work incorporating machine imagery in 1915, he was quoted in the New York Tribune as follows: "The machine has become more than a mere adjunct of life. It is really a part of human life, perhaps the very soul." There he outlines mechanical symbolism as a form, and I quote, "through which to interpret ideas or by which to expose human characteristics," end quote. Suzanne Duchamp's small number of works produced in Paris fill an aching absence. They serve to show how the massive gender-related changes in art and society were being experienced, recorded, and represented not only by the bachelors but also by the bride.
Thank you very much, Ruth, for this nice presentation. Because it was so good in time.
Oh!
Oh my God!
It was a bit over.
Time for questions.
It was still a bit over.
Are there any questions?
Thank you, Thank you, Ruth, for an excellent paper. I was wondering if there was any evolution. The first two works that you showed focus very much on the machine and separation, while the next two works focus much more on the organic and encounter or
Yeah, I think you might be right. I mean, what's unusual, I think, is that the very first one, Un et une menace, for me, is the most interesting. So the very first work that she produces, I mean, of these examples, but also, you know, an early work of her kind of work that can be related to Dadaism is the most radical. Yeah, and then it almost becomes a bit less radical, and you're right, kind of the circular shape. So Jean Crotty worked a lot with these balloons and these circular shapes. It kind of refers to orphism and so on. And then together they have this movement called Taboo. They try a new movement. And this, again, yesterday we were talking a lot about spiritualism and religion and how, on the one hand, they purport to reject it, but it keeps kind of coming up in different ways. And I think she moves more towards these organic circular shapes, perhaps, as part of working with Crotty, but I would have liked to have seen her continue with some of that more, for me, I really like the very bold machine imagery, the starker examples. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Do you see any similarities or kind of developments to Sophie Turner
I mean, connections in terms of the themes in their work, I'm not sure that I do necessarily. In terms of their kind of biographies and their life stories, and I think the fact that they both worked very productively in partnerships, for example, that's something that they have in common. And the new materials, I think, Teuber does much more and much more prolifically and employs a greater range of materials. And she also continues, I think, she continues with a more radical departure from figuration in her work. You know, she keeps going with what she was doing and I think becomes bolder and is so important for abstract art. And what Suzanne Duchamp does eventually is return to the figurative. So it's quite a short, sharp, experimental phase. And then, I mean, that's a question that interests me. What do you do when you've done something so different? How do you continue? And I think it is slightly different for some of the women artists who are not quite so secure in, you know, in all sorts of ways as part of the movements and so on. So I think Teuber really continues down that path of abstraction in a way, and she continues to work very productively in that way. I think Suzanne Duchamp kind of works for a very short time and then changes her mind.
Caroline Hille und Irene Gammel haben heute Morgen eine sehr schöne Zeit, die beiden Künstlerinnen Elsa von Baden-Lorenhofen und Hanna Höch, die Kategorien männlich, weiblich und dominiert haben, aufgelöst haben und in diesen Maschinenbildern von Maschinenkörpern, da haben Sie ja eigentlich, obwohl der Körper als solcher nicht vorkommt, wie Sie es auch erwähnt haben, also die Frau ist nicht zu sehen, der Mann ist nicht zu sehen, aber Sie haben eigentlich sich auf die Suche gemacht, auch in der Nachfolge von Campfield, auf eben diese Symbole. Ist es nun so, dass wirklich Suzanne Duchamp diese Kategorien nicht aufgelöst hat?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It is very hard to escape completely, and you're right that we are perhaps over-tempted to decrypt. In fact, a student said to me last week, why are we searching for meanings? I mean, you forget because it's what you're always trying to find things out and, you know, make sense of things. Our tendency is to want to make sense of something and to read and decode and decrypt. I think you're right. That's the viewer. Sometimes me bringing that to the works. But I think they do resist, in some ways, the categories and the symbolism, and in other ways, one can't help but read it. But I think she does so more than a lot of the Dadaists do. And in comparison to Picabia, you know, I mean, one of the things I think about this idea of collapsing boundaries, I don't think, I love Picabia's work, but I don't think he collapses boundaries at all. I mean, I think in one way it's very different, but this constant recourse to the female as machine is, you know, not really something new or groundbreaking. It's, you know, it reinforces, sometimes I think it reinforces those gender stereotypes, the machine woman, you know, the spark plug we mentioned earlier. I mean, the Baroness then does something different by using her own body. And the question is, what do you do if you don't represent the female body, which is such a, you know, staple of Western art? And so with the machine imagery, there's an attempt to do something very different. But I think in some ways that certainly many of the images with which we're familiar just fall back on the same tropes. You know, it's still the machine woman and the bachelor and the bride and there's lots of female tropes. And you could say it's also approaching it critically. I think she does something very interesting. And it's probably, resists. It does, I think, really attempt to resist this readings. But I can't help it. But I keep reading them. I mean, I've looked at these so many times, and I come back to them and read them differently. And then I think, no, maybe that is that. You know, that's the man and the female. So I think she she does a decent attempt to resist it.
Sie haben Picabia erwähnt und viele seiner Maschinenbilder sind ja tatsächlich erotische Männerfantasien. Es gibt ja zum Beispiel Walla El, Pistole, nachdem dann ein relativ komplizierter, sophistizierter Mechanismus in Gang gesetzt ist, die kann dann ewig schießen. Also gut, der Symbolismus ist relativ obvious, klar. Aber gleichzeitig eben trägt dieses Bild an den Titel Walla El. Da löst er dann ja auch wieder was auf.
Ja. Yeah, I mean, and some of, I mean, there was an exhibition, not recently actually, because it's probably a few years ago, at the Tate Modern of Duchamp, Picabia, and Man Ray, like, you know, the big three. And it was all about the bride and the young girl and the kind of, it just, probably art historians like me, you could say, kept going back to the same old symbols. And I almost, you know, I'm doing it here because you can't help but reference like Marcel's large glass and so on. It is quite tempting to do so, but like Picabia's later painting is just, oh, I better be careful, it's awful. It's terrible. I mean, it's, you know, figurative pictures of girls and, again, fantasies and not terribly interesting because, yeah, as I said, what happens when you've done the interesting thing? What happens to you next? And he goes back to some really kind of cliched paintings of women and, like, voyeuristic and so on and not that interesting, I think. But, you know, I mean, admittedly, even by doing that, they're throwing things into question. And I think there is the question of accessibility. At least if it's a bit accessible, you can see it as a reworking. Sometimes if it's so esoteric, you can't access it. It's not working either, you know. So drawing on tropes or cliches and trying to rework them arguably also helps. And certainly formally they're very interesting. And yeah.
Still at time. So I can answer a question maybe, a simple one. Actually two. Picabia also says that this is, I don't know if it's true, but it's like he's saying that when Picabia arrived in New York and he saw all this new technology, he started doing machine drawings. Is there something similar? Is there like a reason of why Suzanne Duchamp started?
I think some of it was in dialogue with her brother, with Marcel, and there's letters between Marcel Duchamp, Suzanne Duchamp, where he talks about the ready-made and so on. So I think, you know, I think one has to acknowledge that. I don't want to keep making those points of reference, but of course, big people were working in New York and in Paris and sometimes corresponding. So I think some of the ideas or the thing about working with machine imagery, she would have been aware of. I don't think she, you know, necessarily came up with it in a vacuum. At 19, the point when she made the first one, she was in Paris and they were in New York, you know, and then Crotty came over later. But I think some of it would have been in correspondence as well. Yeah.
Maybe a second one, which is maybe connected a little bit to Ina's question, is because I like the diagrams, which I not in my book, and I was wondering, can one read it like a diagram? Like if you have the title first and then there's a kind of diagram to une menace, or is it maybe the other way around? Is it a diagram mode or is it a picture mode where you then set the title?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, does it what the gap, you know, whether it's ancrage or relay, you know, using vast in terms, does it help you or does she come up with it first? I'm not sure. It's interesting because she does inscribe them on the canvas, you know, on the within the picture space as well. So the titles, because, you know, I have those questions about the Baroness is God and all that, you know, that where did the titles come from? She's written it on for us. It's very helpful. We can't avoid it. So it's a very important part of the, you know, it's conceptual, I think, you know, like Marcel Duchamp's work, it's conceptual. And in the example that I think most people like this image more than the others. You know, here she's it really is a part of it. It's very hard to tell whether the verbal came first or the visual, because they're so intertwined. I'd love to know which came first. But yeah, I like the idea of thinking of it as a diagram and something that is...
I think here it's maybe more obvious. It's that description of the picture. But in the first one, yeah. It's also the way you talked about it, that one would think, okay, she had this line in mind, and now how can I show it?
Mm.
That would be the diagram.
Yeah, yeah. Breaking something apart and trying to show it in diagrammatic terms.
Yeah.
Ah, it's an interesting idea.
Also in the last picture you showed, you can also see it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as well.
If this is most obvious. Let's think about seduction. How can you show it as a
diagram? Has a concept, yeah. Yeah, get the word first, the word's very bold, and then, mapping it out kind of thing, isn't it? Mapping out the concept, visualising it.
Little question.
I'm going to the other sex, though. Suzanne Duchamp, she showed with Crotty, I think, right?
Yes, yeah.
What was their connection?
They were married.
They were?
Yeah, yeah. He was her second...
I came to my things.
Oh, okay. No. They were married. So he was married once before, and she was married once before. She was married to a pharmacist in Rouen. It always makes me think of Madame Bovary. Dumped the pharmacist, got together with John Crotty, who was in about 1919 they married. So he came back from New York and they married and worked together and they exhibited together. So in 1921 they had a co-show at the Galerie Montaigne in Paris. Yeah, so she had dialogue with John Crotty and of course with her brother as well, with Marcel Duchamp. Yeah. Yes, he is. Yes, he's Swiss. Yes, he is. Yeah.
We don't have that much time to do the lecture again. One more question.
Cheeky.
Thank you for your talk on Suzanne Duchamp. Could you address something about the colors she used? Because she has these poppy pastel colours which
not been
used the other
daddies. Yeah, okay. I think the colour symbolism, so Jean Crotty, since we're on to Jean Crotty now, he has a kind of index or code, you know, of colours, where red for passion and blue for the ideal, I think, or for creativity, and green for regeneration and fertility. So some of it, I think, they must have discussed together. And when they go on to form Taboo, that is part of their discussions around it, I think they were referring to orphism and in thinking about colour symbolism. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be sure. I mean, where it comes up the most, I think, is in this example, where there's a real contrast, isn't there, between the colours at the pretty pastel colours at the bottom and these kind of darker shapes above. So I don't know if she was programmatic about it, but I know that those whole discussions were, you know, part of what they were thinking about colour symbolism.
It's often pink, blue, yellow.
Yeah.
In these
mechanical colours. Ah, yeah. Right, actually. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, you've made a colour connection. I make the shapes and colours, yeah.
Okay, time's up.
3 minutes over. Oh.